usually contained as 4 or 5 day wars between Armenian forces and Azerbaijan in Nagorno-Karabakh and in the area of the international border between the two states. But I think this could spill over into a longer conflict.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Backstory. I'm Dana Lewis. One of Europe's frozen conflicts has erupted again, fighting between Armenia and Azerbaijan over an area called Nagorno-Karabakh. If you live in America or Canada or elsewhere, it's really hard to worry about it or to care about it, but listen, we ought to. Russia is supporting Armenia. Turkey is behind Azerbaijan. And experts say this could develop into something that could be a much wider conflict. And by the way, it's potentially, and we'll ask our guests who I'm about to introduce you to, is it a product of a wider conflict like Syria, where Russia and Turkey are on opposite sides, or Libya, where Russian supports one warlord and Turkey another? So let's talk to the people who understand this and can explain it better than I can. First of all, Lawrence Brewers is the Caucasus Programs Director at the London-based peace-building organization Conciliation Resources. He has more than 20 years of experience as a researcher in conflicts in the South Caucasus, and he is a practitioner of peace-building initiatives in the region. Hi, Lawrence.
Hi, good to be here.
And Joshua Kuchera is in Tbilisi, Georgia, and the Caucasus editor of Eurasia Net. Hi, Josh.
Hello, thanks for having me.
All right, I said it, but I didn't quite understand it. Europe's frozen conflicts. What does that mean when we're talking about this area? You want to take the first one, Josh?
Sure. Well, when you say frozen conflict, it refers to there were a whole series of conflicts in the former Soviet Union as the Soviet Union collapsed. Abkhazia and South Ossetia in Georgia, there's Transnistria in Moldova, and Nagorno-Karabakh in Azerbaijan. It's a bit of a misnomer to say frozen conflicts at this point. I think the others you can safely call fairly frozen, but Karabakh has been thawing and thawing and thawing, and now it's, you know, practically on fire. So frozen is definitely...
I was just going to say, Lawrence, I mean, this seems like it's not frozen in any way. I mean, this is kinetics. This is fighting that started pretty well a week ago.
Yeah, absolutely. I avoid the term frozen conflict when talking about this particular conflict. I agree with Josh. You know, you can say that perhaps for Transnistria and for Abkhazia and South Ossetia, but since 2014 in particular, we have seen periodic escalations, usually contained as 4 or 5 day wars between Armenian forces and Azerbaijan in Nagorno-Karabakh and in the area of the international border between the two states. But I think this could spill over into a longer conflict.
All right. I've been reading some of the things both of you have written about this. And Lawrence, you in particular, I mean, had a very interesting line where you said, this is like World War I trench warfare that is still to this day being fought in Europe.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I'm often asked is, why should people in Europe care about this conflict? The relevance of the conflict is often framed in terms of energy, oil and gas transit from the Caspian to European markets. And of course, that is significant. But I think much more important are these two other factors. First of all, the potential for this conflict to bring in, to become an object of policy by external powers looking to project influence. And then simply the fact that more than 100 years after the end of the First World War, we see trench warfare. In some places, Armenian and Azerbaijani soldiers are so close that they can hear one another, very reminiscent of those parables of the tragedy of trench warfare in World War I.
Joshua, what is Nagorno-Karabakh, and why does anybody want to fight over it?
So Nagorno-Karabakh, where to start? It's an internationally recognized part of Azerbaijan during the Soviet Union. It was populated by a majority ethnic Armenian population. During the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was an Armenian movement to sort of remove Nagorno-Karabakh from Soviet Azerbaijan and join it to Soviet Armenia. This escalated, and during this point, the Soviet Union collapsed. Armenia and Azerbaijan became independent states, and this became an interstate war. then that war ended, quote unquote, in 1994 with a ceasefire, with Armenians controlling both Nagorno-Karabakh, the former what was under the Soviet Union called an autonomous oblast of Nagorno-Karabakh, as well as a large part of other Azerbaijani territory that had not been part of Nagorno-Karabakh, that was at that point populated almost entirely by ethnic Azerbaijanis. So since 1994, Armenia has controlled that territory. And since that time as well, Azerbaijan has been trying to get it back, either by, there have been long peace negotiations over the past few years. The peace negotiations seem to have lost much hope for success.
Why do they want it back? Is there gold in the hills? Is there,
there's been a deep sense of injustice that Azerbaijanis feel like this has been stolen from them by force. Secondly, there are 600,000 Azerbaijani displaced people who still harbor hopes of being able to return to their homes in that territory.
And Lawrence, I mean, this is, I think that Joshua was trying to do his best to edit long history there. But I mean, before that, the Persians were involved. And before that, Constantinople had a stranglehold over the area.
Yeah, I mean, the South Caucasus, or Transcaucasia as it used to be known, has always been a kind of a field, a forum where surrounding great powers and empires have tried to exert their influence, but it's always been at the very edge of their power. And that's allowed local potentates to a considerable degree of independence. And I think, you know, to come back to the question of why this is so important, you know, for Armenians, Nagorno-Karabakh was one place where a degree of autonomy was preserved long after the medieval Armenian kingdoms had disappeared. And in the context of 20th century genocide, Nagorno-Karabakh is seen as one place where an indigenous Armenian population survived. And so it's seen very much in existential terms. For Azerbaijan, Nagorno-Karabakh is seen as a cradle of culture. There are poets, musicians, and composers who came from the territory, and perhaps beyond that. The territorial integrity of Azerbaijan is what defines Azerbaijan as a nation. You know, you have very large numbers of Azerbaijanis living in Iran, in Georgia. So it is the state, it's the territory of the state that defines that identity more clearly than in any other parameter. And there's a huge sense of grievance, as Josh was underlining, amongst the internally displaced population who do still hope to return to homes. So it's really, so much has been invested in terms of domestic politics into this very hard to step away.
Either one of you can take this, but I mean, is there part of an unclosed chapter in the Armenian genocide, of which, you know, Turkey has been accused of killing 1.5 million people?
Yeah, I mean, I think that consciousness very much frames the Armenian prism, the vision of Nagorno-Karabakh. Nikol Pashinyan has framed what's happening at the moment as existential. And so I think, you know, the fear of renewed ethnic cleansing and genocide of Armenians does drive this conflict. And, you know, what we've seen across the divide in the early 1990s, mass displacement on both sides. There used to be vibrant communities of Armenians in various Azerbaijani cities that are no longer there. Likewise, substantial numbers of Azerbaijanis living in Armenia, all trace of them practically is gone. So, yes, the shadow of ethnic cleansing definitely informs the perceptions of fear today.
Joshua, you're nodding your head.
I mean, Lawrence said that far more eloquently than I could have, but I sign on to everything that he said.
This is one of the most militarized borders in the world. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Either one?
Absolutely. I mean, there's I don't know how many places there are in the world where there's really absolutely no way to cross this border. There's not a single crossing at all. It's front lines from top to bottom.
Yeah. So is this a proxy war between Russia and Turkey? Because, Russia has supplied weapons to Armenia. They have a base in Armenia. I saw, in the initial fighting in the last week that there were some T-72 tanks destroyed. Then there was a report of a Sukhoi downed. You know, these are all Russian aircraft and armor. But at the same time, Russia reportedly supplies the Armenian side as well. It's a great place to sell weapons for Russia.
Yeah, Russia arms both sides. Armenia almost entirely. Azerbaijan has a few other alternative sources of weaponry, but still the large majority of its weapons also come from Russia. But I think it's important to not think of this as a proxy war. It could become a proxy war. I mean, that is a real danger right now, especially with Turkey's kind of newly assertive posture in the region. But I think that to say that it's a proxy war in general is overstated. I mean, the dynamics that are driving it are 100% internal. And like you said, Turkey does back Azerbaijan. Russia has a treaty obligation to defend Armenia if it's invaded. We don't know whether that's going to be activated or not. But still, to at this point look at external factors for the conflict would be to misunderstand it.
Lawrence, would you buy into that? I mean, there's a lot of tension between Russia and Turkey in different places, as we mentioned before, in Syria and Libya. Turkey really rolled out the press, the national press on this when the fighting started, accusing Armenia of being entirely sympathetic of the other side. I mean, do you see it as internal, or do you see some external pulling of the strings?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with Joshua that we should not see this as intrinsically a proxy conflict. The drivers of it are domestic, are local at the national level. But I think what we're seeing is impacts and symptoms of a prolonged crisis in multilateral diplomacy. The Minsk group, which mediates in this conflict of the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, was founded in the 90s in the unipolar moment in a US-led global order. For the last 15 years, that order has been ceding ground to a new kind of multipolarity. And I think what we might be seeing is this shift, multilateral diplomacy to a kind of what you might call a multipolar opportunism. Turkey seeing an opportunity here. It's engaged, it's had a lot of battle experience in Syria, in Libya, and so on in recent years. It has a very active defense industry looking for new markets to demonstrate its goods, and supporting Azerbaijan plays well for domestic legitimacy. And it may be that what we're seeing is the emergence or the embedding of this conflict into one of a number of regional theaters, where Russia and Turkey will be confronting one another, regulating their relations, bargaining and negotiating trade-offs. A key implication of that is that Armenia and Azerbaijan themselves will have less influence over outcomes than they used to have, potentially, under the OSCE multilateral diplomatic model. Now, you could argue, if you were Azerbaijani, that that model hasn't delivered anything, and that's true from an Azerbaijani perspective. So, you know, I think this conflict is now suspended between these different models of diplomacy and multipolarity with very uncertain outcomes.
Well, so that's worrisome because, I mean, you're building a bridge towards saying that America, as a world leader, has kind of left the neighborhood. And then now you have regional powers that suddenly see opportunity and gaps that they can fill. And this is geopolitical, just not in that area, but, you know, throughout the Caucasus and elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, I think we are seeing a new phase of geopoliticization of this conflict. You know, I argued in my book that one of the interesting things about this conflict is that the parties have not been able to really frame their agendas in ways that would resonate with outside powers. I think that that may be changing, and they may become more like proxies than they have been to date. US interests have always been inconsistent, I would say, over the last 15, 20 years. The last time that the US really injected some political capital into this peace process was in 2000, 2001. So yes, I think it's going to be very difficult to bring the parties back to the table. There was a UN Security Council meeting last night that affirmed the Minsk group of the OSCE as the key mediatory body. But so much depends, I think, on the battlefield outcomes of the next few days and weeks.
Is this a religious conflict as well? I mean, we're the, you know, Muslims in Azerbaijan and against the Orthodox Christians in Armenia.
No, not at all. You know, Armenians and Azerbaijanis have far more in common with each other than they do with almost any other people in the world, I would say. And while there's occasional efforts, I think, among an international audience to kind of add a religious element to it, you know, in the U.S., Armenian lobby groups will present this as kind of another group of persecuted Christians in the Middle East. Azerbaijan will occasionally promote this in the Organization of the Islamic Conference or groups like that as, you know, to try to get some Muslim solidarity. But that's really for an external audience. Internally, it's really not very salient. I mean, it should be emphasized here that these people live together for many centuries without any problems. The conflict between Armenians and Azerbaijanis is a relatively recent development in their many centuries of living together. So the religious element should not be overemphasized.
And is Iran stoking this? And does Iran see opportunity here?
No, Iran is almost surprisingly passive in this, given what a big country it is and that both of these countries are on its border. It basically tries to keep good relations with both countries. With Azerbaijan, its relations are a little bit more tense because of, as Lawrence mentioned, the large ethnic Azerbaijani minority in Iran. But basically, Iran tries to stay out of it for the most part, and they do.
All right. If I can just kind of wrap this up, where do you see this heading? Because, I mean, there have been clashes in the last week. There are people trying to mediate. Putin has called for calm and Turkey has called for calm. I don't know how sincere some of those calls are. Where does it go now? Lawrence, do you want to take this?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that, I mean, we're on the hinge now. We're beyond a kind of a four-day conflict. It's been very difficult to get a sense of how the battle's going on the ground. If there would be kind of rapid military success, either through the recapture of significant territory on the part of Azerbaijan or the successful repulsion of Azerbaijani operations by Armenian forces, I think you could then have the scope for Russia to step in and perhaps force a ceasefire. But if it becomes more protracted, then I think Moscow and Ankara will be faced with difficult choices about when and how and to what degree to come in and support their protégés, so to speak. As I mentioned, I think it's going to be very difficult at this particular moment to concentrate sufficient international attention on a diplomatic effort. So I think it's wide open what could happen.
Joshua, last word to you.
No, absolutely. I mean, we're kind of in uncharted territory, and you know, this is the most serious fighting that has happened since the early 90s, and you know, we don't know.
Joshua Kuchera in Tbilisi, Georgia, and Lawrence Brewers, both you know, great to have your insight and to bring us up to speed on this. And thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And that's this edition of Backstory. Please subscribe to the podcast. I think it's the best international news podcast there is in terms of content and high-caliber guests. I'm Dana Lewis. I'm a former correspondent in Jerusalem, in Moscow. I've covered half a dozen different war zones, reported out of some 55 countries. Support Backstory, and we'll keep bringing you stories that matter. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you again soon.